Hey, for real though, it wasn't that long ago. At Royal Rumble, y'all know what it was. It was rough. But a lot of my progression and a lot of my focus and motivation came from that night. So in a weird hindsight way, thank you so much, guys. Because that's, hey, life ain't fair, and sometimes you gotta get kicked in the ass to get better, and that's what happened. And that's why we're here now. Thank you so much. I'll never forget tonight.
You like me right now. You like me.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the street.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
I'm fat! You haven't been beat up properly! Woo!
38 days until Lucha Underground Season 2. We are still counting down here on the show. January 27th on the El Rey Network. Cannot wait. This is episode 414 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, December 20th, 2015. I am the Solid Monster. Now, I noticed there was a professor from one of the local universities in New Hampshire who asked a question during the Democratic debate last night, whose last name happened to be Levesque. And they were in New Hampshire, which just so happens to be where Paul Levesque grew up. And I believe his family still lives there. So I'm left to wonder, you know, how common is that last name in the state of New Hampshire? Because if it isn't, I wonder if there's any relation there. Guy certainly didn't look anything like Triple H, but you never know. Could be a second cousin removed or something. It was a question actually about student loans, a subject that I take great interest in seeing is how I am still paying mine back after all of these years. At variable rates, no less. They finally raised interest rates this week. That was the other big story. Finally raised interest rates for the first time in a decade. I wanted to fucking vomit when I heard that. It makes me physically ill. You know, my stomach aches whenever I hear talk about an interest rate hike. And it looks like more are on the way next year, which means Bad News Barrett is going to be paying me a few visits next year. And so now you know why I sit through Raw each and every week for you guys. So on that note, let's do some plugs. Audible is still, wink wink, Audible is still offering listeners of this podcast a free 30-day trial of the Audible service. We are, of course, headed toward the end of the year. 10 more days left here as I record this in 2015. And you can use our URL, audibletrial.com/solidmonster. Every time you do so, if you sign up, it's not enough just to plug it in. You got to sign up for the free trial. Once you do that, the show gets a little kickback from it. A little bit of support comes our way. And you can also get yourself a free audiobook. So if you want to check out the Brock Lesnar Death Clutch book, if you want to check out the Daniel Bryan Yes book, if you want, which I still haven't gotten to, but I will. Chris Jericho's third book is up there. All three of his books are great. Shawn Michaels' book. I mean, there's a ton of wrestling books, and you can get it for free. Even if you cancel in those 30 days, you say, this Audible thing's not for me, you still get to keep your free book. So audibletrial.com/solidmonster. Let's try to get some more signups here before the end of the year. If you like what you hear every week, please consider making a PayPal donation on thesolidmonster.com. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname. You'll see the PayPal box on the right-hand side of the page. Thank you very much to Chuck Lunatic Lentz, who has been so supportive throughout the entire year. The guy really is a lunatic, and I mean that in a good way. You are awesome. As are John Loose Cannon Lopez and Deadpool James Herrera. I'm sure you've heard those names quite a bit. They are very big supporters of the show. Brian Hitman Hurst, Dream Chaser, Chauncey Curry, Handsome Eric Guy, Bobby the Wizard Waldrop, Killshot Keith Hart, Rhiannon the Dolly Monster Lacentin, The Boss Carlos Torrens, Cheryl Oh So Good, Crime Boss Christopher Cavazos, and the Court Jester, James Fraley, who hosts the Best for Business podcast, which I recommend you check out right now at best4business.podbean.com. So check him out. And again, if you want to make a donation, You can do so at any time on thesolemonster.com, day or night. Also, don't forget that time is quickly running out to nominate this podcast for the Wrestling Radio Awards. You can go to WrestlingRadioAwards.com and write in the full name of the show, Solomonster Sounds Off, under the category for Show of the Year, if you want to support this podcast in the awards. I'm going to be doing, I don't know how many of you, I know a lot of you actually became fans of this podcast and know about this show because of TV Tracks, and you know, he'll post clips during the week. He's been very supportive of this podcast over the years. And a couple of years ago, I did a Tracks exclusive Q&A for his channel. Just 90 minutes of me doing nothing but answering questions that people sent in to me. So I'm doing another one. I'm doing another exclusive Q&A, a holiday Q&A for the TV Tracks channel. And I'm planning, my plan right now is to record on Christmas Eve. So it is not too late to send in questions if you do so. There's a thread on the channel, but you could also email me. If you do, make sure TV Tracks is in caps somewhere in the subject line so I know what it's for. But yeah, the last one I did, it was 2 years ago, over 50,000 views. I answered like 40 or 50 questions. I'm going to try to get to as many as I can. So if you want to submit a question, I would advise you to make it brief. And it can pretty much be about anything. And again, make sure TV Tracks is in the subject line somewhere and email them at thesolemonster@gmail.com. We are starting our WCW countdown this week. I mentioned to everybody last week, who's starting kind of an ambitious project, I had put a list together of my, in my opinion, the top matches in WCW history. These are not going to be ranked from 15 to 1. There's no rank order here. But they are the 15 best matches in WCW history. We're talking the WCW era here. I want this to be WCW-centric. I was going to include some matches from Jim Crockett Promotions. I mean, there were so many great ones. I decided against it because that would end up taking up more than half the list anyway, but I wanted this to be WCW-centric. So we're really talking from 1989 onward. And the whole purpose of doing this countdown, as of last week, we are 15 weeks away now, 14 weeks away. Actually, what am I talking about? No, it starts this week. As of this week, we are exactly 15 weeks away from the anniversary of the death of WCW. And I consider the anniversary to be the airing of the very last Nitro, which took place on March 26, 2001. This countdown should culminate here on this show on March 27th, I believe, or whatever that Sunday is. We're going to do one match per week, very similar to what we did with my WWE countdown several weeks ago. And we are going to start, we're going to do the match after the mailbag. We're going to start with match number one. And I can tell you that it is a War Games match. And that is the only hint I am giving for now. So you'll want to stay tuned for that. Just to follow up on something I mentioned during the mailbag on last week's show, I posted a tweet about it. I posted on Facebook. Not everybody may have seen it, so I just want to clarify here. I talked about the Diamond Dallas Page stuff. After the show went up last Sunday, I got a call from DDP, and it has all been worked out. So all is well. We'll even have DDP on the podcast in a few weeks. He's got a lot of irons in the fire to talk about right now. And also, it's the perfect timing because with this WCW countdown that I'm doing, that's something I definitely want to get into with him. You know, the whole, you know, the rise and fall, essentially, of WCW and his involvement in helping. I mean, he was a very big part of that boom that that promotion had in the late 90s and really was one, in my opinion, of only two guys that WCW really made. Or you know, I mean, in a lot of ways, he helped make himself. But two of the real original kind of organically created stars of that WCW period were Goldberg and DDP. You know, Sting was obviously a big part of that boom, but he was already an established star. A lot of the other guys had been brought over from WWE, or jumped over, I should say. So I think it'll be good. We'll talk about that and a lot of other stuff when we have him on in a couple of weeks. Sports Illustrated broke the news that Mauro Ranallo, who had been the play-by-play voice for New Japan Pro Wrestling on Access Television, will be the new voice of SmackDown when it moves to USA on January 7th. He said Michael Cole reached out to him by email a while back to see if he had any interest in coming in. Ranallo is a huge wrestling fan, has been his whole life, so obviously it was a no-brainer for him to come on over. WWE is allowing him to keep his boxing and MMA commitments, so he'll still be doing that. Obviously, he's not going to be able to do New Japan anymore. They touted the fact in their own press release when WWE put theirs out that Ronaldo was the one who called the Mayweather-Pacquiao fight on, I guess there was an international feed for international viewers, and he was the play-by-play guy for the biggest boxing fight ever. So, which is a pretty big deal. And it's a big plus for SmackDown. You know, Mauro and Josh Barnett, from the few episodes I saw of New Japan on Access, and I only saw about three or four of them when they first started, those two guys were probably the best announced team, and may, up until now, have still been the best announced team in all of wrestling. I mean, those guys were awesome together. It's too bad they can't boot Lawler out of there and just have Ronaldo and Josh Barnett calling SmackDown. But the key, of course, is how they make him change his style, if they make him change too much, which I'm sure they will. You know, if they just turn him into every other WWE announcer, then it's just a waste of the guy's talents, and I think it's a waste of money for whatever they're paying him. So I hope they let him do his own thing within the parameters, of course, that they set for him. He'll have to change a little bit, but hopefully not too much. It's not enough to get me to watch SmackDown every week, although I'm definitely going to be tuning in for that first show just to see how he does. They have piqued my interest, but this doesn't mean I'm watching SmackDown every week. I was on with Mish and Joey on their Wrestling Soup TLC post-show last Sunday. I want to say thank you to them again for having me on. I thought TLC overall was good. I wouldn't go much beyond that. It was a good show overall. I did enjoy Raw and TakeOver more, but that's three good to very good shows in a row. So good for WWE. I put a poll up on Twitter when the show was over. Over 1,600 votes, 56% of you said Tater Tots up, 44% said Tater Tots down. So not a large majority, but the majority did like the show more than they hated it. It was very heel-heavy in terms of the winners, as I predicted it would be. The only title that changed hands was the Intercontinental, and I figure it was really only because when they looked at the card and they realized all the heels were going over, which had Kevin Owens won, it would have been all of the heels winning on the show. They realized that, hey, we need one babyface to be triumphant here, and Dean Ambrose was their pick. You know, the Intercontinental is something that they could just change. It doesn't really interfere with any major plans, and they could easily put the belt back on Owens by or before the Rumble if they wanted to. And to his credit, you know, Dean Ambrose, when he won, he made that win feel like such a big deal when that match was over. Just the way he was acting, he was all excited and celebrating, and he wasn't crying, but he was just so happy to have won that Intercontinental title, that he did a good job with it, and it was a good match they had. There was that one line during their match from Jerry Lawler during the Intercontinental match when Kevin Owens got a finger on the bottom rope to break up a pin. He barely got his finger on the rope, too. He was a little too far away, almost didn't reach it, but he got a finger on the rope to break up a pinfall. And Lawler just goes, oh, one finger on the rope, big deal. And I'm just like, big deal? It's the rules. That's kind of a big deal. He's a Browns fan. That'd be like Johnny Manziel throwing a pass and the receiver catches it at the 1 yard line. He's like, oh, come on, he was close enough. Give him the touchdown. You know, a heel announcer might say that. Old King might say that. But I mean, Jesus Christ. So that was a stupid thing for him to say. And we got the screwjob finish in the main event, which I didn't like, but they followed it up with Roman Reigns snapping on Triple H and just beating the shit out of him. And just Roman Reigns showing some much-needed aggression that's been missing from his character for a very long time. So I thought they ended very strong, and that's why I call it a good show. And by the way, Brock Lesnar and Alberto Del Rio had their match at last night's house show in Los Angeles. Predictable DQ finish. Rusev ran in. We all knew Lesnar wasn't winning the U.S. title, so I don't think the DQ was much of a surprise. Somebody uploaded the full match online. I watched it before I started recording here. It was suplex, 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 armbar, fights out of it, suplex, suplex, F5 attempt, and Rusev kicks him in the face and DQ. So now you don't have to watch it. I just gave you the whole match. Yeah, I do wish Brock would add a few new things to his arsenal. I know he's got it in him. I mean, I know he does. He was such a great wrestler during his first run. You don't just forget that. You know, and again, it's not like, yeah, he was very agile and he can move around very quick. Maybe he's maybe he's not quite as fast as he used to be, although he's still pretty freaking fast. But you don't forget that stuff. It's not like he was doing all this high-flying shit that he can't do anymore. You know, I know he can do it. I know he doesn't have to. People want to see Suplex City, but it does get a little redundant after a while. And this was a house show match, so, you know, maximum effort probably not involved here. But I do think at some point those two could have a pretty good match on TV, and it doesn't just have to be, you know, suplex after suplex after suplex. I could envision a storyline where Brock Lesnar has to run through the League of Nations heading into WrestleMania, kind of culminating in a match with the leader, who I guess in this case would be Sheamus. But to me, Sheamus is not nearly strong enough to be a WrestleMania opponent for Brock Lesnar, at least not right now. I mean, if they had a true top heel leading that faction, that would be a natural story. You have Brock run through all the League of Nations members. I guess Barrett's hurt, but, you know, Rusev and Del Rio, so we can get the Del Rio match on TV or on a pay-per-view. And then once he does that, he gets to, you know, the leader. Problem is, Sheamus isn't that person. So Lesnar versus Roman Reigns, I think, still seems like the natural direction to me for WrestleMania. Monday Night Raw this past week was live from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Up nearly a million viewers from the previous week. Their biggest number since August, which was right before the descent began. And football has something to do with that, but football's not the only reason for it. And I think the rating this week was well-deserved. We did the Raw poll on Twitter. 2,059 votes. It's funny to me that Dixie Carter does a Twitter poll on her page and does only 2,000 votes, and here I'm doing that on my page on a weekly basis. 85% thumbs up, 15% thumbs down, which is quite the turnaround from the last few weeks. It was a very good show with an excellent finish. Roman Reigns is the new WWE World Heavyweight Champion after Vince McMahon decided enough of this shit. Sometimes you want to do something, you got to do it yourself. And he said, if nobody else can get Roman Reigns over, then by God, I will. And he made his return to TV for the first time in more than a year. And by the time the show was over, they had the fans in Philly who booed Reigns out of the building in January when he won the Royal Rumble. They had them chanting, "You deserve it," by the time this show was over. So the question is it going to last? I don't know. Are they going to just strip him of the title tomorrow night? I doubt it. You know, I mean, look, the guy may have finally turned a corner after all of these months and everything they've tried. Maybe they actually turned a corner, and it's not just a Philadelphia thing, you know, and he's lost and lost and lost every time he's come close to winning the championship. Every time he's come close to winning the big one, whether it was WrestleMania or whether it was Money in the Bank or whether it was Survivor Series or whenever, he's come so close. He finally wins the big one. He loses again. Then he wins it back. He's not Daniel Bryan. Daniel Bryan could lose over and over and over again, and the fans still hung with him because they looked at him as the underdog, and they respected him, and they wanted to see him succeed. He had a certain connection with the fans that, yes, even though he was losing over and over and getting screwed over and over, they hung with him. Roman Reigns does not have the kind of fan support that Daniel Bryan had. He loses one too many times, and you know what? He really could end up being Lex Luger. Although Roman Reigns is a better wrestler than Lex Luger ever was. There were some people who were appalled that I said that it was an excellent show, or a very good show, that they, you know, they handled Roman Reigns finally the right way, which they did. One person, I have to mention this, one person emailed me and just goes, in all caps, he goes, "Explain yourself." He goes, "I saw what you said about Raw. Explain yourself." Explain myself? What am I, under investigation? There isn't much to explain. I watched the show, it ended, I enjoyed it. Sounds pretty simple to me. It's like that idiot that one time with the email, "You better answer," which I never did, by the way. They kept his talking to a minimum on the show. He still did more than he should have with the talking. It wasn't perfect, but it was kept to a minimum. There was nothing cringeworthy, at least. He Superman punched a senior citizen, and he won the title. And then on SmackDown, look, I saw their YouTube channel. They had a segment where Sheamus had Roman Reigns kicked out of the building. He sent a bunch of security guards to the ring to remove him, and Reigns absolutely murdered this one guy, this little security guy, or the smallest of the bunch anyway, that came to the ring. He grabbed him. He was supposed to shove him backwards, and he was going to kind of fall out over the top rope, this guy, but the guy didn't go over. He had trouble getting over. So Roman just shoves him over anyway with all of with just such force. This guy bounced, but it's okay because his face broke the fall. Literally, his face, he landed right on his face, he bounced. Oh, this looked brutal, but in a good way. Maybe not for the security guy. But murderous Roman Reigns is the best Roman Reigns. How long have I been saying that for, okay? Silent but deadly. They haven't quite mastered the silent part yet, but he needs to be an ass-kicking machine, not the John Cena joke machine. And that's what I saw more of this past week, starting at TLC with the Triple H beatdown. And I've seen it more in the last week than I have since the Shield days out of this guy. They just need to keep doing that. The other thing I noticed about that SmackDown segment was the big security guy that Roman Reigns knocked out at the end. I recognized him right away. It was TJ Marconi, who wrestles independents here in the Northeast. He's wrestled on those Five Borough Wrestling shows I've been to before. Many times teaming with Stockade, who, as you all know, I'm not very fond of. My knees are not very fond of him. I think they actually teamed together on Friday night, but I couldn't make it to the show. But anyway, I recognized Marconi right away. Now, the show on Monday, it wasn't perfect. It opened with Stephanie McMahon doing what Stephanie McMahon does, which is castrating the babyfaces on TV without any retribution, because, of course, these guys aren't going to hit her back. So as she stands there slapping the shit out of Roman Reigns over and over and over again, what does Roman Reigns do? He stands there and he smiles. She slapped him so hard, his face began to visibly swell up. She told him, "I'm not going to fire you because my husband told me not to, but my father, the chairman of the board, he's going to be here to see you later tonight." And everybody cheered. It is amazing how the one guy responsible for all of this horrible television they keep feeding us for the last few months is so beloved when he's on TV. People just love that Mr. McMahon character. And when you're off TV as long as he's been, absence makes the heart grow fonder. You know, I've said before, I think that Vince McMahon is the greatest wrestling heel of all time. That character, even at 70 years old, he plays it so well. He is the best heel they've ever had, and it's not even close. You can rattle off the name of every great heel they've ever had, from Roddy Piper to Randy Savage to Jake Roberts to, you know, maybe Shawn Michaels when he was a dick back in the late 90s, and, you know, Triple H or Edge or Jericho in 08. Every great heel this company has ever seen, they're all great, but they're not Vince McMahon. Kevin Owens, who lost the Intercontinental title the night before, came out to ruin a pretty good match between Dean Ambrose and Dolph Ziggler. He laid them both out with pop-up power bombs. I like this because they really put him over strong here. It would have been very easy for him to lose the title and then just kind of fade away. But he came out here like a killer. He killed them both. It was nice to see that coming off the loss. He is pissed off that he lost his title, and now he's unhinged. The son of Adonis, bro. Okay, bro? The son of Adonis. I'm telling you, the son of Adonis. This was good stuff. We had a very unique segment that, you know, WWE has their own way of doing their backstage segments. Pretty much they all suck. This was different. This was pre-taped, obviously. I think they even had some, like, background music playing, but it was Bubba Ray Dudley, not looking like the goofball with the tape on the glasses, just Bubba Ray Dudley, looking more like Bully Ray. Backstage, hanging out, there's D-Von, there's Tommy Dreamer, there's Rhino, they're somewhere in the back. And looking directly into the camera, cutting a promo on the Wyatt family, talking about how things didn't exactly go their way, which they didn't at TLC, they lost. But now they're in the city of hardcore. They're in the city where all of them made a name for themselves in the old ECW, and they would splice in old ECW clips as they were talking, which was kind of cool. And it reminded me, like, wow, Bubba Ray Dudley used to be fat. And so I give the guy a lot of credit. He really did reinvent himself. Each guy had some speaking time to cut little promos on the Wyatts. This was very old school. I love this. I want to see them do some more segments like this. I think I like this more just because it was different than your typical backstage promo, and different is good. It's good to change up the format every now and then. And they announced that tonight they were going to have an 8-man Extreme Rules tag team match with the Wyatt family. R-Truth wrapped to the ring for a match with Bo Dallas. This was just a backdrop for Vince McMahon's arrival. He told both of them to get the hell out of my ring. Be gone, you jobbers. Actually, he didn't say that last part, but that's basically what he was implying. He actually did that at a house show many years ago. There was some really boring match, and he just came out and told them to leave. I think it may have been at the Nassau Coliseum, but I don't know why Vince would have been at a house show at Nassau. So maybe it was the Garden or something, but anyway, he said he was going to make Roman Reigns sweat a little bit more. He was going to make him wait. He took a seat at ringside. They went to commercial. Clearly, they were just stalling until they hit the top of the hour. And once it hit like 9 o'clock, he got up. He called out Roman Reigns. Vince wanted Roman to apologize for what he did to his son-in-law at TLC. He said Triple H was back home in Connecticut suffering. That's the word he used. That's what he said. I don't know. I mean, he didn't look like he was suffering to me on Wednesday. Yeah, Triple H opened that NXT TakeOver show in London, like he usually does. I was hoping they would let William Regal do it, but Regal left the tour early because he had some neck problems he was having from the surgery that he had many weeks ago. So unfortunately, he missed the show. And Triple H at least addressed the fact that, yes, I got my ass kicked on Sunday, but I would rather be dead before I miss this show. So at least he acknowledged it, but it was still stupid for him to be out there. You know, I know he's proud and all, but that's your main storyline right now, you know? I mean, Roman Reigns is the WWE champion. He sent Triple H out in an ambulance a couple of days before. I know the guy has mutant healing powers. He once got dropped 50 feet upside down in a car and missed only a week of TV without so much as a scratch on him. But it's just goofy to have Vince McMahon on television saying, oh, my son-in-law is back home suffering. And meanwhile, his son-in-law is on Twitter posting pictures from London, all smiles. Maybe Vince has some other son-in-law that we're not aware of. So Roman wouldn't apologize. Vince took his jacket off. He threatened to fight him when Sheamus, doing his best Dude Love impersonation, interrupted and stopped the fight from happening. Some of you will get that reference, I hope. Sheamus said he'd be willing to put the title on the line again against Reigns, and Vince McMahon teased the fans and asked them, hey, you want a championship match here tonight? And they all cheered like sheep, and then he told them how gullible they are to fall for it every single time. No match for you. Roman again talked about someone's balls, which is becoming a creepy obsession of his. He said that Vince McMahon used to have grapefruits, and now he's just got some shriveled up prunes. Prunes and tater tots. What a meal. What a meal that would be. What food will he add next? We should all try to guess what food Roman Reigns will use in his next description of someone's testicles. He then committed the cardinal sin by mentioning Vince McMahon's age, and he called him an old man. Vince called him a son of a bitch, and he granted him his title match, but on one condition. If he does not win the championship, he is fired. And at that point, I tweeted out that we're getting a new champion tonight, because there really was no other outcome. I mean, yes, they could have screwed him again. They could have done a firing angle, which we've seen them do a million fucking times. But he could not fail again. You cannot have this guy fail again on back-to-back nights, no less. You just can't do that. He had to win. And before Vince walked away, he went to shake Roman's hand, but he kicked him in the junk instead. So first, Stephanie slaps the shit out of him, and now Vince kicks him in the balls. And this I would have been much angrier about had he not been able to punch Vince in the face at the end of the show. You know, I think he should have given Stephanie a super bitch punch, but maybe that's just me. Neville pinned Tyler Breeze with the red arrow while Miz, who was pretending to be a director, that's his new gimmick now, he was shouting stuff at Neville. He was directing him through a megaphone at ringside. Tyler Breeze, by the way, also lost to Titus O'Neil on SmackDown. So they seem to be transitioning him into a program with Goldust. Goldust was out there. He was posing with his selfie stick at ringside. You know, the best I can hope for is that Tyler Breeze doesn't end up like Zack Ryder or Heath Slater, who only show up on Superstars and most of the time end up losing. Just a body to have on the roster so other people can benefit. You know, and that's a shame because the guy's got real talent. Even if you're not a fan of his gimmick, I mean, I am. I've been a fan of his since, you know, he first started using this character on NXT. But on NXT, at least on the TakeOver shows, we had a real chance to see what this guy can do in the ring. And at different times, I would see flashes of Shawn Michaels, or I would see flashes of Dolph Ziggler. I mean, He's got that athleticism. He is that good. On the main roster, he hasn't been up very long, but it's been a few months now, and we have yet to really see him break out with that one big breakout match. I wasn't really impressed by what I saw, like I think it was Survivor Series, when he had the match with Ziggler. This is not what this guy is capable of. He is so much better than, you know, the silly gimmick that he has, which I think works for him. He makes it work. But the guy is really good. And he spent 5 years in developmental. I'm pretty sure he started there in 2010. You know, Lance Storm trained him. He was in developmental for 5 years before he finally hit on something. He came very close, perilously close to being cut. And he came up with this character, and he just hit it off. He finally hit on something, and he deserves a real shot, not to end up getting lumped in with all the guys they've given up on. So after the match, Miz told Neville he wants to shadow him so that he can learn to speak with his English accent and become the next James Bond. This could end up being entertaining. But this is not what I was hoping for Neville when he got called up. And I could rant on Neville all day long. The fact is, he is getting TV time. He is involved in a storyline. And yes, it could turn out to be entertaining. Not everybody can be a main eventer at the moment. Here's my issue with that argument, okay? That's absolutely true. I've heard people say that before. Not everybody can be a main eventer. Not everybody. Maybe one day Neville will be a headliner, but it doesn't have to be right away, okay? Here's my problem with that. We find ourselves at a time right now where they need to really, really, really build new stars. Look at the heel side. Because they didn't turn Roman, they didn't turn Dean back at Survivor Series. They opted to go with Sheamus, at least for a month, as the lead heel. Because that's the best they have to offer. They don't have a strong heel anywhere on that roster. Once Seth Rollins went down, they were fucked. Unless they turned somebody, which they still haven't. And maybe they will, but they haven't. And I know Brock will be back. Maybe when Brock comes back, they actually push him more toward the heel side. They could do that. I mean, you can go either way with Brock. I think people are still going to cheer him, you know, and Cena's going to be back in the next couple of weeks, and it ain't like they're turning him. You can forget about that. And on the babyface side, you know, even there, not very strong right now, stronger than the heel side, but I wouldn't say, oh, look at all these top babyfaces they have, right? I mean, the lack of depth because of injuries and just the inability over the years to really create big stars, like really big stars. They find themselves in this situation where I don't buy that as an excuse. There isn't this dearth of talent on top right now where, oh, there's no room for Neville. You know, it's like, oh, well, Neville's going to have to wait his turn. Like the Attitude Era, you had Austin and Rock and Foley and Triple H and Taker. And it's like, if a guy like Neville, well, first of all, if a guy like Neville came along in 98, just the way he looks, he wouldn't have had a shot. At least now he's got a little bit more of a chance. But it's not like you have all of that talent, and man, Neville's great, but we're kind of stacked up right now, so he's going to have to wait his turn. He can be a top star right now, at this moment. He's the kind of guy, I look at him like a Ricochet, or like there's certain names out there, these guys that you watch. And you know what? Rob Van Dam was kind of like that when he first came to WWE, when he came over and he made his debut that very first night against Tommy Dreamer, and this was the first exposure a lot of people had to Van Damme. And he had the feud, I think, for the hardcore title with Jeff Hardy. And at the beginning there, those first few months, this guy, I would watch his matches and just be like wowed by the things I would see. Because it's not like I hadn't seen him before. But now that I'm having a chance to watch him every single week, and he's, you know, he was much younger back then. He's going out there and he's probably motivated. He's on the big stage. And Rob Van Dam would do the most amazing things in his matches. And it was so much fun to watch this guy work. Every now and then you got a guy that comes along who can do stuff like that that just makes your jaw drop. And Neville is one of those guys. So, yes, he's small, and they love to make fun of his big floppy ears because they're a bunch of assholes who don't realize what they're doing every single time they make fun of his ears. They don't realize how they're damaging the guy. Because now that's all people are going to think about. I mean, yeah, you could look at his big ears, but if you don't focus on them and you focus instead on what makes the guy so great, people aren't going to worry about what he looks like. They're not going to worry about his ears. But no, to them, it's comedy. Hey, let's make fun of his Dumbo ears because they're a bunch of fucking idiots. You know, Neville is, I don't know if once in a lifetime, but he's that kind of performer. He's that good. He's much better than what they have him doing now, you know, in the mid-card with Miz. Miz is in the perfect position right now. I think this role for the Miz, to his credit, he's great at it. I love seeing Miz not wrestling and doing other stuff. Okay, that's the role for him to be in. But Neville is just leagues ahead of this guy. Maybe not in terms of speaking. I will say, you know, Miz is very well spoken, very articulate. He's very good at that. But in almost every other category, Neville just blows him out of the water. So I look at this and I say, yeah, hopefully it turned out to be entertaining, but my God, what a waste. What a waste of what they could be doing with this guy. At a time when they need stars. I go back to that point. Why are you not using a guy like this to get him as high as you possibly can? Maybe not Roman Reigns level, but why is he down here when he should be up here? You need guys. What are you doing? It's not like they're calling up Samoa Joe from NXT or any of those guys, which they fucking should. Especially now that, I don't know if Joe's going to get a rematch with Balor, but that thing seems to have run its course. What do you do with Joe now? I don't know why he's not on the main roster. Boy, you know, they could use a heel. There's your heel, right there. But I don't know what goes through their heads sometimes. So anyway, that's my long-winded rant right there. I hope it's entertaining. That's all I'll say. It has comedic potential. But I think Neville's potential shouldn't be comedic, I guess is the point I'm trying to make here. We have the Wyatt family against the Dudleys. Tommy Dreamer and Rhino in an Extreme Rules 8-man tag team match. Now, I am not a huge fan of these types of matches anymore because I think I've just become so desensitized to them. But I love this match. I think this was just the chaotic nature of it. It was just so unlike what we're used to seeing on this show. Like that promo I talked about earlier in the show. It was just different. This was not your typical Raw match. This was not your typical Raw segment. And it was long, too. They gave these guys 15 minutes to go out there and just beat the hell out of each other. And my God, you know, TNA would do at least one of these every single week on their television show. That's why I would mock them for it. And maybe they still do. I wouldn't know. I haven't watched a full episode of Impact in probably 5 or 6 months. But everything on this show is just, it's usually so formulaic and rigid, and you can call it before it even happens. And here it was 8 dudes just beating the shit out of each other for 15 minutes straight. And it was Philadelphia, so that's why they did it. You know, I guess it made sense, the home of hardcore. It was exactly the kind of match you would expect to see between the Wyatts and the Dudleys. I don't want to see these guys doing collar and elbow tie-ups. I don't want to see these guys exchanging chin locks. Got plenty of guys on the roster who can do that. I want these guys to go out there and have a fucking fight. And that is what they did. And it even had some pretty good near falls. Tommy Dreamer gave Luke Harper a Death Valley driver off the Raw stage through 2 tables. They threw Eric Rowan a bone by letting him get the pin for his team. He did a top rope splash onto Rhino through a table. This turned out to be a lot more fun than I expected it to be, so I give this a thumbs up. The New Day came out all serious. They weren't being funny at all, very reserved. They invited the Lucha Dragons and the Usos out to apologize to them for their actions the night before. They complimented them on just being great opponents. This was apparently a recreation of a promo that Edge and Christian did with the Hardys and the Dudleys, I think, after the first TLC match. I think that's what one of you guys told me anyway. I don't remember that personally, but I don't doubt that it happened. The babyfaces weren't really buying it, but they shook hands with the New Day anyway. And as they went to leave, the New Day dropped their phony humbleness and they started doing their usual shtick and being very loud and obnoxious, which led to the Usos and the Lucha Dragons running back down to the ring and kicking their ass. The Usos and the Lucha Dragons were booed for their actions. They came off like babies here. And I don't mean baby faces. So I'm not sure what they were trying to accomplish, but it may have been the opposite of what they were trying to accomplish. And I'm also not sure where they go next as far as the tag team titles go. I don't know if they're trying to recreate the Edge and Christian Hardys Dudleys dynamic by putting these guys in a program for months on end, and they're going to have another ladder match or some other crazy match. I don't know if that's what they're going for here. And if they are, good luck. I mean, these are 3 very talented teams, but I don't know that you can recreate the magic of that from all those years ago. But I also think they have to move on to other teams. You can't just go with the same three over and over again. And Titus O'Neil, you know, they seem to be doing something singles-wise with him and Stardust and not with Darren Young. Usos and Lucha Dragons, like I said, I mean, they got their shot already. Who else is there? Unless you call up some teams from NXT like Enzo Amore and Colin Cassidy or Jason Jordan and Chad Gable. That would get me excited about the tag team division. I mean, it would gut NXT, which I would hate, but they're going to have to do something soon. And I look at those two teams, and to me, those guys are ready. Kaz and Enzo, they've been in NXT a long time now. And especially after what happened at the TakeOver show, it almost makes me think that maybe that is the direction they're headed in, that they are maybe going to get a call-up soon. I don't know, but I look at them, I look at Jordan and Gable, who are just fucking phenomenal. And you add two teams like that to the tag team division with the New Day, with the Usos, and let them go out there and have matches together. And now you're talking. Now you're speaking my language. Right now, it almost seems like they've kind of hit a wall. You don't want to take the titles off New Day. I don't look at anybody on the current roster and say, hey, they should take the belts off New Day and put them on them. So who do you go to next? You got to bring up somebody new. Charlotte and Becky beat Brie Mode and Alicia Fox when Ric Flair tripped Alicia Fox behind the ref's back, and Becky as well. She didn't see what happened. She locked in the disarmer for the submission, celebrated, none the wiser, that Flair had interfered. So they are telling a story, hopefully, that leads to Becky getting the next title shot against Charlotte. Charlotte can win, and they can go on and have Charlotte defend against Sasha Banks at WrestleMania. At least that's the direction that I hope they're going in. And you know what? If they even wanted to do a triple threat, I wouldn't hate it if they wanted to do Charlotte, Sasha, and Becky just to get them all involved. Me personally, I would like to see a singles match with the women at WrestleMania. I'm trying to think when the last time was that they did a singles match with the women for the championship. And you know, I cannot think of any match going back maybe to Trish and Mickey at WrestleMania 22, which is, it's going to be a decade. I mean, could it really be that long? Decade, let me see here. They've done a bunch of tag team matches, I know that. And in New Orleans, they did a big battle royal for AJ's title. Well, this year they did a fucking tag team match. I don't even think the women's title was on the line. Let's see here. I know in Miami, that was the first Mania that I went to. I don't even remember a women's match. Oh, actually, I think it was Maria Menounos and Kelly Kelly against Beth Phoenix and Eve, maybe? I don't know. But yeah, you know what? It may actually be WrestleMania 22. That may have been the last time that the women's or divas or whatever championship was defended in a singles match. If it is, I think it's high time that we get a singles match. So I would prefer Charlotte and Sasha. And I think they could have a great match. You put the title on Sasha. It just makes way too much sense, which is probably why they won't do it. Roman Reigns and Sheamus for the WWE World Heavyweight Championship. The last time the WWE title changed hands on this show before this was July 25th of 2011 when John Cena beat Rey Mysterio. Rey Mysterio, who had only won the championship at the beginning of the show, and they had Cena beat him for it at the end. That was over 4 years ago. So when your ratings are tanking, what do? You give the people a major title change. And that's exactly what they did. I enjoyed this match much more than I did their TLC match because they had the crowd in the palm of their hands for most of it. Maybe just like the last half. But it got exciting there toward the end. They told a good story. The payoff at the end, that didn't hurt either. Nor did the blood. The blood added to the match. I think it made Roman Reigns more sympathetic. And I'm just used to having championship matches like this where, you know, both guys end up bleeding and one of them's got the fucking, you know, crimson mask on and everything. I mean, that to me, I don't know. That to me screams like big time championship match. So I think the blood helped. He gave Sheamus a headbutt. That's how he got opened up. Face covered in blood. And God only knows what was going through Vince McMahon's head. He was there. He was at ringside. He was looking directly at Roman Reigns when he came up with the blood all over his face. He was standing right there looking at it. God knows what was going through his head. They were going to the finish anyway, so I mean, there really was nothing they could do without just killing the flow of the match. Reigns had Sheamus beat with a spear. Vince yanked the referee out of the ring. at the very last second to a great reaction. Sheamus hits white noise, only gets two. Vince gets up on the apron. He's now conversing with the referee. League of Nations runs down to attack Reigns. Everybody except Wade Barrett, who apparently is out with nerve damage in his neck. Reigns laid waste to all of them with Superman punches. Superman punched to Sheamus. Superman punched to Vince McMahon, who collapsed unconscious on the apron. Reigns then turned around into a brogue kick to the face. And I love this. This was great because they've protected that kick so much. I think everybody was convinced that it was over at this point. I mean, you could hear the groans when he hit that brogue kick, and when Roman kicked out, the people flipped their shit. Sheamus couldn't believe it. He started pounding his chest like an idiot to telegraph to Roman Reigns what was coming. Which, by the way, if you're ever in a fight, don't do that. Don't let the other person know what you're about to do. And that turned out to be his undoing. He went for the kick, Roman caught him with a spear, got the three, and Roman Reigns is your new WWE champion. So the good guys finally won one. Doesn't happen very often on this show, but it did here. And so for one night, I give them props. And in the spirit of Christmas, I wrote this down. I'm going to recite this here for you. Philly rejoiced, not a boo to be heard, except from the usual internet nerds. Hey, that's us. Now Roman's the champ, looking all big and strong, while Vince looks at us and says, "See, you were wrong." But the fans, they know better. They've been fooled in the past. Please, for the love of God, just let him kick ass. That's all I got. Now, they could strip him of the title tomorrow night and then hold it up in the Royal Rumble match with the winner becoming champion. And that could be real interesting if you have, let's say, Roman Reigns in there trying to get the belt back, Cena, Lesnar, maybe Undertaker, maybe Triple H. You put them all in the Royal Rumble match. I'd actually love that idea if they did not already put the title on Roman Reigns on this show. Once they did that, I just think it would be a big mistake now to take it away from him a second time. So I pray that they don't just turn around and strip him of the championship predictably tomorrow night. As much as I do like that idea for the Rumble, I mean, they could still stack the Rumble with a bunch of big names. I just think, you know, once you put the belt on him the second time, you can't take it off. You know, he's got the new side plates now, I saw. I think he's in for the long haul, this time as champion. So, a very good show. I enjoyed it. Hopefully that guy who wrote in asking me to explain myself now is satisfied, and if not, well, I don't know what to tell you, brother. The Slammy Awards, I can tell you this, they are this Monday. You can vote now in a bunch of categories. You cannot vote yet on the main categories. You can do so tomorrow night. The big one being Superstar of the Year. And unlike in years past, they're opening up the voting to where you can vote for anyone on the roster for Superstar of the Year. Damian Sandow went on Twitter. He pointed out that if he wins a Slammy, that means he has to accept it, which means he gets a live mic on television. They should have a category for Biggest Fuck-Up of the Year. It would be an endless list. But Damian Sandow would be near the top. Mizdow, yeah, it's hard for me to believe one of the categories had Damian Mizdow turns on Miz, and I'm like, wow, that happened this year. It feels like a lifetime ago. Mizdow was so over, and then they did the split, and they gave him mic time on that one Raw show. He just came out as himself and spoke from the heart, and people gave him a standing ovation, and then he became Macho Mandow, never to be heard from again. It is a crime that this guy sits in the back every single week with nothing to do. I'll vote for him. I'll vote for him, and you should too. By the way, I'm going to be doing my top 10 matches for the year, not just WWE, on next week's podcast. So, happy guessing.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
NXT is the hottest ticket in wrestling right now. Tickets went on sale for dates in Chicago, Detroit, Milwaukee, and Pittsburgh, and sold out across the board. They also sold out all the tickets to their WrestleMania weekend show in Dallas, which I believe is a takeover special. I will be there myself. Looking forward to hopefully seeing some of you there. And speaking of takeover, NXT TakeOver London. A really fun show. Not the best takeover they've done this year. It'd be further down on the list if you put a whole list together ranking them. But still a very enjoyable show. Better than TLC. A lot's been made about the crowd in London. I wanted to talk about this. I don't really see what the problem is. I mean, this became like a big controversy and oh, the crowd in London. I fail to see where the controversy is. They're British. That's what they do. They go to sporting events, they sing, they dance, they chant, they have fun. They were loud all night. They weren't sitting on their hands like crowds over here do for most Raws and most pay-per-views. Although, to be fair to us, it's not so much that we're shitty fans. You know, we're comparing a typical Raw show to an NXT TakeOver show, which is unfair. But I salute them. These are the same people that helped make those post-WrestleMania Raw shows so much fun, except here, in this case, on this show, I didn't hear a single "We Are Awesome" chant. It was all about the people and the characters on this show. They liked Bayley, so they sang for Bayley. It made the show fun. I was way more bothered by how much they darkened the arena before each match. I mean, I'm sure they do it to probably keep the focus on the action in the ring or some such thing, but I like it much better with the lights raised up enough to where you can actually see the crowd and you can see the stage in the background. So that I didn't like. But the crowd, I thought the crowd was great. I fail to see what the issue is. They did do one thing that annoyed me, but there was a great payoff in the end. Throughout the entire show, every time the referee would start counting, the crowd would be one number ahead. So if he counted six, they would chant seven. And it threw me off for a bit. I was all confused. I was all discombobulated there when they first started doing that. They did this all night long until the main event. I think Joe and Finn were down. They were trying to make it back up to their feet before the count of ten. When the referee yelled nine, and I don't know if this was their plan or what, but this was great. The referee yells nine, and the fans all broke out in a chant of 10 while doing the Ty Dillinger deal with their hands. That was fucking great. That was a nice little payoff to what was an annoying thing they were doing, but in the end, all was forgiven, because that was awesome. So they open with Asuka and Emma. This was my favorite match on the entire... This is my favorite match of the entire week. This was the match of the night, easily. They did a women's division match. That's what they called it, so hopefully that means the end of the word divas on this brand. Dead and buried, hopefully. 15 minutes they gave these two, and the fans were with them every step of the way. I don't think this was the first match of the entire night either, because the TV taping they did, I would imagine the TV taping was done before this. Although I know the Sami Zayn match may have been at the very end, but they did tape TV that's going to air this Wednesday. So it's not like, oh, well, these two women were the first people they saw all night, and so of course they got a great reaction. No, I don't think they were the first people that they saw. They just really fucking loved Asuka, and they wanted to see a great match. And lots of Asuka's gonna kill you, and let's go Asuka chants, and this is wrestling chants, which I still think is kind of dumb. This was the most selling that we've seen Asuka do. She was on defense for a good part of the match, more so than any NXT match we've seen her in so far. And I'm happy for Emma. I'm also happy for her. And Emma, by the way, I gotta say, looked hot as hell on this show. Emma's a very attractive girl, but she was just wow on this show. Emma doesn't get a lot of attention with everyone so focused, I think, on, you know, the Sashas and the Baileys of the brand, but this was the Emma that I remember from that first TakeOver show against Paige. People tend to forget, you know, when this whole... They talk about the Divas Revolution. You know what? You could trace the so-called Divas Revolution back to Paige and Emma on that first TakeOver special. That's a match, you know, and a feud that doesn't get nearly enough attention. Nearly as much attention, I should say. So I want to give her some here. But Asuka, you know, when she would do her comeback, she would scream, like this primal scream. She's so good at all those little things, the facial expressions and mannerisms and screaming and staring and smiling and licking her lips. And, you know, one minute she's like kind of sexy, and then the next minute you're kind of terrified of her. I'm sure some people listening to the show have had girlfriends like that before. We got some Aja Kong-esque spinning backfists from Asuka in this match as well. I especially liked when the referee told Asuka to please kick out after the Emma sandwich in the corner. I think the guy was having flashbacks to the show in Brooklyn when Becky Lynch forgot to kick out, because it was the same referee. I thought that was funny. She got her in the Asuka lock. Dana Brooke jumped up on the apron to distract the ref. Emma was tapping out. The referee didn't see it. I thought for sure we were getting a screw job at that point. but Asuka ended up nailing her with a spin kick of death to the face, and she pinned her. A great match. Just, I can't say anything bad about it. They teased a future match later in the show between Asuka and Nia Jax. They had a little bit of a backstage confrontation there. That kind of intrigues me. Nia's not that good yet, but you know, neither was Dana Brooke at the time, and she wrestled Asuka, and they had a good match. So it's not out of the realm of possibility that Asuka could go in there with a Nia Jax and they could pull out a really good match. But yeah, this was the main event was a close second, but to me, this was the match of the night right here. Dash and Dawson against Kaz and Enzo. Kaz and Enzo over big time in the UK. I was bummed by the finish. Actually, the finish itself was really cool. Dash and Dawson, they hit their Shatter Machine move, which is like a giant leaping code breaker. They did it from the top rope. So they killed Enzo with it, and they pinned him. But it did surprise me. I thought for sure they were doing the title switch here. Maybe they are main roster bound. That's the only thing that makes sense to me, because I don't know what the fuck you do with these two guys now. You know, even if you're of the argument, you know, they're kind of like the New Age Outlaws back in the day, or, I mean, you can rattle off other names of guys who were so over, and they were so popular. They had their own little shtick. They didn't necessarily need the belts. I don't buy that with these two. I think when that moment comes and they win the championships, it's going to be a big celebration. But, you know, maybe they're saving it for the main roster. And even if you do buy into that argument that Kaz and Enzo don't need the belts, it's like, well, what do they do, though? You know what I mean? Like, they have tag teams on NXT, but not that many, so where do they go from here? And that's why I think maybe they're going to get the call-up soon. But you can tell that finish really took the air out of the arena. I think everybody expected a title change and was hoping for it. And when they didn't deliver, they were kind of bummed. But the match itself was actually pretty good. Baron Corbin and Apollo Crews. I thought this was disappointing. There was just something missing. I don't know what it was, but there was something missing here. I didn't think it was as good as some of Corbin's more recent matches on the TakeOver specials. Or like the match with Joe in Brooklyn. I thought that was better. At one point, this was the highlight of the entire match, Corbin threw Crews out of the ring, and he's talking trash, which I like. It's one of the things about Baron Corbin I like. He'll talk shit about you during the match. He goes over to the ropes, and he's talking trash down onto Crews, and he just tells him, go back to Ring of Honor. Which is funny, because I don't think Apollo Crews ever wrestled a single match in Ring of Honor. But I do like the trash talk from Corbin. I've been keeping up with Breaking Ground. I haven't been reviewing it here on the show, but I have been watching the episodes of Breaking Ground on the network, and I saw a thread on our Facebook page where somebody asked, you know, who do you like more after watching Breaking Ground? And my answer was Baron Corbin. The guy comes off as a total dick, but yet I like him more now than I did before. There's nothing cookie-cutter about him. He speaks his mind, even if it doesn't, you know, cast him in a positive light. And he wants to be in main events. That's his only goal. He doesn't care about anything else or anyone else. He just wants to be the headliner. He's not here to make friends. He's not there because he grew up loving pro wrestling. He played football. He did very well at it. And now he wants to be successful doing this. And he'll do whatever he has to do to get to the top. I like that. So anyway, he kicked out of Apollo's standing moonsault and ended up pinning him clean with the End of Days. They are protecting that thing like they do the brogue kick and the pedigree. That's why that near fall, I think, works so well on Raw. Because, like I said earlier, nobody kicks out of that fucking brogue kick. And so when Roman did, the fans reacted accordingly. And it looks like the End of Days may end up being one of those types of moves. Bayley and Nia Jax for the Women's Championship. If you went into this expecting Sasha versus Bayley, you were disappointed. Of course, if you went into this expecting that, given how inexperienced Nia Jax is, then I would tell you to go get your head examined. This was a match that it told a good story. And that story was that Bayley was the massive underdog. And for the first time, in order to win, she had to find a way to beat somebody much bigger than she is. She had all those matches with Charlotte and Sasha, but they were all pretty much the same size. Nia Jax is by far the biggest woman that Bayley has ever set foot in the ring with. And in the end, she found a way to win. She made Nia tap out to a guillotine choke, which was the third or fourth time she tried to put that move on. Finally, she found success with it. It took Bayley out of her element. It forced her to change her style up a little bit, which I liked. She adapted. The match itself was, you know, really nothing special, but it got better as it got closer to the end. And the fans, You know, you can say what you want to about the match, and it was, you know, maybe some people were disappointed by it. The fans loved Bayley so much, they were just, I mean, at an energy level of beyond 100 on a scale of 0 to 100 for this entire match. They serenaded her with song. I mean, even if the match completely sucked, there was no way these people were turning on Bayley or booing her. They sang to her. I hope this woman never leaves NXT. That's the message I got out of this. I don't want to see her ever leave NXT. Nia used her power. She was ragdolling Bayley around early on, the way Chyna used to do to Marlena. She gave her multiple Samoan drops, multiple leg drops, all but killed her finish dead. I will say that. I mean, that's her big finish, and Bayley kicked out of like 4 fucking leg drops in this match. She's going to have to come up with a new move after this. My big knock on the match is that they went back to a lot of the same moves over and over. It got very repetitive. Whether it was Nia with the multiple leg drops or Bayley with the multiple choke attempts. I mean, they were telling a story with the chokes that she tried and tried and tried and finally it worked, but it just got very repetitive. It's like, okay, we get it. You know, that kind of thing. But by the end, when she locked that choke in and Bayley's just screaming, like, tap out, tap out, and then she finally does and the place explodes, it ended well. It built to a very good finish. I was not a big fan early, but by the end, they won me over. Probably the worst takeover match that Bayley has had all year, but not a bad match. You can't compare this to those other matches because those other matches were so different, and the I think the experience level also of the women that were in those matches. Nia Jax, she's only been in wrestling here for a matter of months. She's still very new. She's still very green and inexperienced. You can't really compare that to a Sasha or a Becky, these women that have been wrestling for God knows how many years. So, yeah, that's why I say the worst takeover match by far, I think, that Bayley has had, but by no means a bad match. I was surprised Eva Marie wasn't out there in Nia's corner. I mean, that fucking crowd would have eaten her alive. It's the one time I actually missed having Eva Marie out there. And the main event was Finn Balor and Samoa Joe for the NXT Championship. They spelled Samoa wrong on the lower third of the screen when Joe came out. They spelled it Samoa. I'm not sure how something like that happens, but it did. Balor came out dressed as Jack the Ripper, which was just a hat and a coat over his usual demon war paint. I do wish they would let him change the paint up and come out in different costumes like he used to do in Japan. Yeah, he was pretty creative with a lot of the stuff he came up with, and I feel like they've stifled a lot of that creativity, which I guess WWE tends to do sometimes. And, you know, it doesn't even have to, oh, the Joker. He can't be the Joker because that's a copyrighted character. It doesn't have to be a copyrighted character. He can dress up as a billion different things that don't infringe on anyone's copyright. So I wish they would let him do that. This was a very good match. Easily would have been the match of the night, but I can't not give it to Asuka and Emma, so this was the second best match of the night to me. We had, you know, Finn chopping Joe off the top rope, coming down onto him with the double foot stomp for the pin. It kind of felt like maybe something was going to happen afterward because they had some time left in the show, and Finn just kept, you know, walking around the ring. I was thinking maybe Hideo would come out, but, you know, nothing happened. Dr. Z-Pac checked on Balor in the ring, and that was it. Baron Corbin now is positioned as the number one contender, so that's probably the next match, Balor and Corbin. Sami Zayn is going to be back on TV this week. Hideo Itami should not be too far behind, so they've got some people they can work back into the mix here on top. I hope Joe is still part of that. You know, he's just been too good lately to just phase him out the way they did with Rhino, so I hope they keep him in the top mix. I really would prefer they bring him to the main roster, even if they want to save him for the Rumble or something, because they can use a heel, and Joe as a heel right now is just fucking great, so I don't know why you wouldn't want to make use of that on your main roster. You know, Triple H brought Rhino in to help on NXT work with the younger guys and put them over, and when they had a need for him, Rhino returned on Monday Night Raw, so it's not out of the realm of possibility that once Joe, and maybe he's at that point now, where he's done his job, they used him for what they wanted to use him for, and now they're moving on. Promote him to the main roster. If the main roster is good enough for Rhino, however old he is now, and Rhino's still very good. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't look much different than he did 10, 15 years ago. So I don't look at Rhino and go, oh, why is this old guy on TV? Rhino fits in just fine. Joe would fit in just fine, too. If it's good enough for Rhino, it's good enough for Joe. I say get him up there. They could really use him right now. On the TNA front, those of you here in the Northeast who have Cablevision as your cable provider, as I do, Pop TV, the new home of TNA, is being added to the channel lineup starting on January 15th. It'll be channel 154. So I wanted to pass that note along for anybody who may be interested. Ring of Honor. I did not see Final Battle, but I know that Jay Lethal did retain his ROH title clean over AJ Styles. Styles' back seemed to hold up well. Dalton Castle got his boys back, even though he lost again to Silas Young. And War Machine are the new Ring of Honor Tag Team Champions, beating the Kingdom, Mike Bennett and Matt Taven. Taven suffered a knee injury early on in the match. I don't know how serious, but he did hurt his knee. Match only went 3 minutes because of it. And it looks like Mike Bennett and Maria Kanellis are officially done with Ring of Honor. They could not come to terms with the company, and so now they are TNA bound. I would expect them to debut probably on that first live show they have on Pop TV, which I think is January 5th, I believe. TNA has been looking for some surprise names to add to the show. So I think Mike Bennett and Maria, if they are on that show, and I would be kind of surprised if they weren't, I don't know that those will be the only two names that they add to that show. This week's ROH TV show, I did watch it. It was mostly just squashes to help build guys up for Final Battle, which is fine. I don't have a problem with that. It just wasn't an overly exciting show. Adam Cole beat Corey Hollis, whose name I recognize from NXT. He actually looked better here than he has on NXT. War Machine and Dalton Castle, they won their own squash matches. Kevin Kelly interviewed Jerry Lynn, who looks very different now. He shaved off the mustache. He cut his long hair. He actually looks better. Every time I would look at him before, I just kept thinking Randy the Ram. So Jerry Lynn was out there, and Kevin Kelly tried to get him to reveal who he thought would win at Final Battle between AJ Styles and Jay Lethal. Lethal came out before he could answer the question, and Jerry Lynn called him an arrogant prick. Lethal teased beating him up, but he didn't do it. I know Lynn did do commentary for Lethal's match at Final Battle, which normally screams angle alert, but he didn't do anything. He didn't get involved. I think Lethal used Jerry Lynn's finishing move. I had read that, and I didn't realize that there's the, what the hell is it called? It's like a type of pile driver that Lynn would use as his finishing move. And in the results for the pay-per-view that I was reading, they said that was Lynn's move. And before the Lethal injection that he beat Styles with, Lethal used that pile driver. So, I don't know where this is going. Jerry Lynn is done. I don't think he's wrestling again. He retired. He had major neck surgery that I think he's still recovering from. He's not wrestling. So, unless he ends up turning and joining the House of Truth as like a manager for Jay Lethal, I don't really understand the point of any of this. Main event on the show was Matt Sydal and ACH beating Roppongi Vice, Rocky Romero and Trent Barretta. Good match, but not what I expected to see on the last show before Final Battle. I don't know if AJ Styles was there for the tapings in the building that they did. I think he was, so why not do a face-off between him and Jay Lethal on the last show? You know, the one thing I will say about Ring of Honor TV shows, and it's a similar type of deal with NXT, because it's only an hour long. They cannot fit everybody on the show every single week. So AJ Styles is a great example of someone who rarely appears on Ring of Honor TV, and when he does, it feels special. Same for the Young Bucks. And I like that, but I still think he should have been on this show. So with that, let's get to your questions here in the popular mailbag segment. You can email me, thesolemnmonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Steven from Appleton, Wisconsin. I know almost nothing about the Dude Love character. Most of my exposure to Mick Foley has been through YouTube clips or career highlights from Raw when the Dude is largely ignored by WWE because he does not fit in with Mick's hardcore narrative. As far as I can tell, Dude Love is just Mick Foley impersonating Dusty Rhodes at Woodstock. Is Dude Love better off forgotten, or is there more to this character? See, now I'm not going to be able to get the image of Dusty Rhodes at Woodstock out of my head now. They did explain this before he ever debuted the character on TV, back when Foley did a very, very famous three-part sit-down interview with Jim Ross on Raw. They showed home footage of him dressed as Dude Love when he was a teenager. And how they introduced the character was actually kind of clever. Stone Cold needed a tag team partner because he and Shawn Michaels, they had been teaming up. They were the tag team champions. But this was 1997, and Shawn Michaels was Shawn Michaels. And so he couldn't wrestle for whatever reason. This may have been when he and Bret Hart got into their little cat fight backstage, and Shawn got all pissy and walked out. So Austin needed a new partner, and Mankind volunteered to be his partner. But Austin wanted nothing to do with him. He's a freak. I don't want you as my partner. And it was hilarious because Mankind would come out every week on TV with a sign around his neck that said, "Pick me, Steve." And finally, Austin's out there. He's wrestling, I think, Owen Hart and the British Bulldog all by himself. And out in the middle of the match comes Dude Love. And they won the belts. And he had to resort to a persona other than Mankind in order to become Austin's tag team partner. So that was really the genesis behind the character's debut. It is the weakest of all three characters. I would say it is better off forgotten, except for the fact that he had those matches as Dude Love against Steve Austin in 98 after Austin won the belt. They needed an opponent right out of the chute for Austin to look strong against and to beat after he won the championship at WrestleMania. So they went with Foley, and he was playing the Dude Love character at the time. And, more specifically, that Over the Edge match, and that was on my list of greatest WWE matches of all time that I put together. That match is so great, I have a soft spot for the character just because of that match. You know, and some people say, "Oh, it ruined his hardcore image." The guy wore a fucking sock puppet on his hand for how many years? You know, when he feuded with Triple H as Cactus Jack, people bought into it, despite that. When he feuded with Randy Orton and did all that hardcore shit, the people bought into it. When he turned heel to team with Edge at that ECW One Night Stand show, people bought into it. So Dude Love didn't ruin anything. It was a weak character, but it didn't ruin anything. It was fine. Anthony in the UK. My question relates to Hulk Hogan and his supposed refusal to put over younger or lesser-known talent. There are stories about Hogan refusing to job for the likes of Bret Hart, Jeff Jarrett, Shawn Michaels, and even Stone Cold Steve Austin. Taking into account all of these instances, my question is, why did Hogan apparently have no issues putting Brock Lesnar over clean in 2002? There are no stories about Hogan playing his creative control card with regards to Brock, so I'm guessing Hogan didn't have a problem doing the job on this occasion. Do you have any insight into this? I believe it was to set up a rematch at Survivor Series that year, which was at Madison Square Garden. Hogan would have been over huge in that building. They wanted, and this is a story I had always heard, they wanted Hogan to lose to Lesnar again. So this would have been two losses in a row. And he did not want to lose a second time. So they went instead with Big Show. Big Show was the backup plan. Hogan disappeared from TV after that SmackDown match. He ended up not coming back until the following year. And in fact, there was another angle to this where Hogan wanted to win the championship. So it wasn't just that Hogan didn't want to lose twice. He wanted to beat Brock and MSG and win the WWE title. I'm sure in Hogan's mind, I'll lose to this guy now, provided I come back and beat him and win the title. That had to be the mentality. Plus, the difference between Brock Lesnar and guys like Bret Hart or Shawn Michaels or Jeff Jarrett, none of those guys looked like Brock Lesnar. Brock Lesnar was a freak. It's like Hogan saying that he won't lose the title to Little Bret Hart, but I'll drop it to Yokozuna instead. Why? Because he's big and believable. Now, to be fair to Hogan, Hogan had already done a ton of jobs in 2002. I don't want to make it sound like Hulk Hogan wouldn't lose to anybody. I think Hulk Hogan was probably at his most generous. The most generous year of his career was 2002. Vince put every single one of his top guys over him. He lost to The Rock at WrestleMania. He did beat Triple H for the title, but then Triple H got his win back and pinned him on SmackDown a few months later with a pedigree. He lost the title to The Undertaker. He tapped out clean in the middle of the ring to Kurt Angle at the King of the Ring, which may have been the biggest one that stands out to me. I think that's the first and only time in Hogan's career that he has ever submitted to somebody as a babyface, which is big. I can't think of any other example in his WWF or WCW run as a babyface where Hulk Hogan tapped out or submitted clean as a sheet. Not, like, knocked out by outside interference or, you know, tapping out but the referee didn't see it. Or, you know, in WCW when he was Hollywood Hogan, he tapped out to the Scorpion Deathlock. I mean, he was a heel. This was probably the only time I could think of that he ever did that, which has to be a huge honor for Kurt Angle. That's a big feather in Kurt's cap that nobody else can say that. So he lost to Kurt, and, you know, he lost to a bear hug against Brock Lesnar. It wasn't an F5. He beat him in a bear hug. Now, that wasn't a verbal submission. He passed out. But that's a lot of losing for a guy that wasn't used to losing that much. You know, and to be honest with you, I don't even know why they wasted that Lesnar-Hogan match on SmackDown. That might have been the go-home show to SummerSlam. They were building to Lesnar and The Rock. I mean, Hogan was, he was an old guy, but he was still a big enough star where you could have gotten a pay-per-view match out of that. I don't know how the quality of the match would have been. I don't know that you would have wanted to end the show with it, because back then, I mean, they typically had all these kick-ass main events on their pay-per-views. But you can do a double main event, have your championship match, and then on the underneath you have Hogan versus Lesnar. I think that'd be a big draw on pay-per-view the first time, but they blew it off on SmackDown. But you know what? I mean, it does lend credence to the plans to come back and have a rematch. Maybe that's why. Because they were going to have the rematch on pay-per-view at Survivor Series. And so that's why. The whole time, the plan was, let's do it on TV. We'll come back with the rematch. And then Hogan said no. John Drix from Montreal. I saw a picture online listing former WCW champions, and Chris Benoit's face was on it. Can you shed some light on this? From whom did he win the title, and how long was his reign? It was their last-ditch effort to keep him from leaving and going to WWE. Bret Hart got kicked in the head by Goldberg. He ended up having to vacate the WCW title. So it was held up in a match between Benoit and Sid. Benoit beat Sid. And then the next day, so it wasn't even a full 24 hours, he gave up the belt. This was not on TV, by the way. He gave up the belt and got his release from WCW along with Perry Saturn, Dean Malenko, and Eddie Guerrero. And the reason was Kevin Sullivan was booking for WCW at the time. He and Benoit had a history together, and it was not a good history. And as long as he was in power, I think Benoit and the rest of them knew they were never going to get pushed. They were doomed, and so they wanted out. There were stories that Mike Graham pulled a knife on them. Mike Graham was he was an agent in WCW at the time. He was working with Kevin Sullivan. So he pulled a knife on them, supposedly, and that may have been used as leverage to get their release, because then they could sue for unsafe working conditions. It does make sense, and I don't know if the knife story is 100% accurate, but it does make sense, because why in the world would WCW let four of their stars out of their contracts all at once, let them out of their contracts early, so they can waltz right into WWE? That makes absolutely no sense. That, more than anything, I think, if it's true, the story about Mike Graham would explain why they allowed that to happen, because otherwise, you'd have to be completely fucking brain dead. But then again, this was WCW in 2000, so it's very possible that the people there were brain dead, that they would just let those four guys walk out the way they did. Chris, which was worse? Hulk Hogan ruining Hulk Hogan running in at WrestleMania 9 to avenge Bret Hart and beat Yokozuna for the championship, or the time that John Cena returned from injury and conveniently found his way into a title match at the 2008 Survivor Series against Chris Jericho? Well, as a kid, I thought Hogan winning the title at WrestleMania was awesome. I was filled with joy when he won the championship. Looking back on it, I still have a soft spot for the finish, but it really is ridiculous the way that whole thing went down. It was very obvious they just wanted to get the belt off Bret, get it on Hogan. I think the John Cena thing was worse, because there was absolutely no reason for him to walk right back in to a championship match. There was no build-up at all. There was no prior heat with Jericho. I don't even think they had wrestled for years before that. Jericho was in the middle of the greatest run of his career as a heel that year. He had just come off that phenomenal program with Shawn Michaels. Cena had been out hurt since the match with Batista at SummerSlam, which he lost, by the way. The last match we saw this guy in, he was pinned clean in the middle. He comes back, and in his first match, he gets a title shot, and he beats Jericho for the belt. That makes even less sense to me than the Hogan thing. At least with the Hogan thing, Mr. Fuji's out there. He's issuing a challenge to Hogan. Bret Hart's there, blinded. He can't even see this fucking guy. He's like, go for it, go for it. He's giving Hogan his endorsement to go ahead and accept the challenge. I mean, what's Hogan going to say? No. So the Cena thing to me was just dumb. At least with the Hogan thing, there's, you know, a semi-logical explanation for it. Raul from Switzerland. Imagine you had to wrestle a match, and you are as untrained as you are today, but can choose your coworker. Which wrestler from any era in his prime would you choose to protect you as good as he can, and so you could get through the match unharmed and healthy? Bret Hart. Bret Hart. That's the guy I would want to work with. Because not only do I think Bret Hart would keep me safe, right? That's all. Bret loves to talk about that. I never hurt anybody in my career. I never hurt, you know, harmed a hair on anyone's head. But Bret Hart could probably carry me to like a 3-star match at least. And I'm sure, you know, if I got in the ring, I would be fucking terrible. But Bret Hart has wrestled a lot of fucking terrible guys in his day. There's the classic story of him and Tom McGee. I'm sure you've heard that story. I may have even talked about this on the podcast before. It was like 86. So Bret Hart was still a tag team wrestler. He was doing the tag team thing with Anvil. But there's he looked like a bodybuilder. This guy, Tom McGee, I don't know what experience he had in wrestling. I've only seen him, I know what he looks like. I've seen a few of his matches. I'm sure if you search online for Tom McGee, you know, he was this guy, had kind of shoulder-length long hair, very athletic. You know, good-looking guy. I mean, I could see why Vince would want to build around him. The problem is, he sucked. He was fucking terrible. And the classic story is that Vince McMahon saw Tom McGee work with Bret Hart. I think it was a dark match at a show. It never aired on TV or anything. I would love to see video of this match. But apparently it was a great match, and Tom McGee looked like $1 million, and Vince McMahon was soiling himself. He thought he had found the next Hulk Hogan. He was already looking beyond Hogan. This was in 86, which was probably the peak of Hogan, okay? And he just thought this was an incredible match. Oh my God, this guy, he's big, he's athletic, he's good looking. Holy, he's got a full head of hair, unlike Hogan. Holy shit, we can build around this guy. And then, unfortunately, Tom McGee worked with people other than Bret Hart, and they quickly realized that this guy was no good. But Bret Hart made this guy look like $1 million. It's the classic story. And so, I'm not just picking Bret because he'd keep me safe. I'm picking him because, you know, he would make me look like fucking, I don't know, I was not going to say Shawn Michaels, but he'd make me look like fucking Dolph Ziggler or something in there, you know? So in his prime, at his peak, yeah, I'm going with Bret. Speaking of Bret Hart, Drew from San Diego, X-Pac was recently on WrestleTalk TV, and while talking about Daniel Bryan, he brought up Bret Hart. He felt Bret was always the fallback guy because he was reliable, but Vince was always looking to put somebody else on top. He brought up Lex Luger being groomed for that spot and how that fell through. I found this interesting because even though Bret is a great wrestler, it always seemed like they were looking for guys to replace him on top, from Luger in 93 to Diesel in 95, and I would even say Shawn Michaels in 96. Do you think Bret was a fallback guy? Yeah, I think he was in a lot of ways. I mean, Bret, you know, they built around Bret. Bret was the face of that new generation era, even more than Shawn Michaels was. And business was not great during that time. But business was not great in general. I'm not excusing Bret, but, you know, the business was in the shitter. I mean, it was the fucking Dark Ages. They were coming off the steroid trial. I mean, it was bad, man. It was, I mean, maybe not in Japan or something, but it was bad times, you know, for WWF and WCW in that, like, 1994 or 95 period. But Bret, every time he would get to the top, yeah, it did feel that way. You know, when he won the championship in 92, they had to get the belt on somebody who didn't look like a roided-up monster, so they went with Bret. They gave him a few months with the belt, and then it was right to Yokozuna because they wanted to build Yokozuna up as a monster heel. And, you know, he lost it to Hogan, but then he got it back. And, you know, Yokozuna pretty much had a stranglehold on that belt for a year. They were going to put the championship on Lex Luger. They were going to do it at SummerSlam, and Vince had a change of heart and said, hey, I want to wait until WrestleMania, which was a huge mistake. And it turned out that the fans were more into Bret than they were Lex. And to their credit, they made a change, right? Remember the whole Royal Rumble thing in 94? They did the thing at the end, which was absolutely a test to see who the fans would cheer for more, Bret or Lex. And they cheered for Bret. And so they reverse course, and instead of Lex getting the belt at WrestleMania 10, they put it on Bret. And they said, he's our guy. So when they put the championship on him in 94, that was the point that it felt okay, they're actually going to get behind him. He didn't really feel like a fallback guy so much. They kept the belt on him for most of the year before he lost it to Bob Backlund. And it was only to get the belt on Diesel. Diesel came along. Vince looked at Diesel probably the way he looked at Tom McGee back in 86, right, that I just talked about that, and said, oh my God, this guy is good looking. He's tall. He's got long flowing hair. He's got a good sense of humor. You know, he probably said, excuse me, and ducked into the bathroom for a few minutes. So Vince found his guy. He found his new Hogan, except he wasn't. And they did very, very poorly with Diesel on top in 95. So what happened? They put the belt back on Bret. But they only put the belt back on Bret because they were getting ready to groom Shawn Michaels as the next guy. All right, we're going to build around this guy now. So they put the belt on Shawn, and Bret went away. And, you know, it was the same song and dance where they were looking to replace Bret. Bret was very bothered by it. I think he kind of knew that Shawn was going to be the next guy, but, you know, he was offended. He thought he was doing a good job with the championship in you know, early 96, and here they want to take it off of him. And look, I mean, Bret's going to feel that way. He wants to be the guy. Everybody wants to be the guy. I think it was probably time for Shawn to get his shot. But yeah, it always feels like they were looking for someone else. They were looking for the next Hogan. And they never, ever looked at Bret as being the next Hogan. But that was the idea. We want the next Hogan here that we can build around, and Bret was not that guy. So aside from when he won the championship at WrestleMania 10, that was the closest it felt to like real confidence in him, like, okay, he's going to be our guy. And again, he had the belt for much of the year. He had the great feud with Owen. But the person they were always looking for was not Bret. Bret was there. He was reliable. He was a great worker. Again, he can make anybody look good. He can have great matches. And it was the fan support. I mean, the fan support is really, you know, it's kind of like Daniel Bryan. Were it not for the fan support that Daniel Bryan had in 2013 into the beginning of 2014, there is not a fucking chance in hell he would have been wrestling for the championship, let alone winning it and making Batista tap out on that show. There is not a snowball's... He had a snowball's chance in hell of that happening, were it not for the fan support and the fans getting behind him the way they did. And once Punk left, you know, it was like, all right, well, I guess we have to go with this guy. With Bret, if he didn't have the kind of fan support he had, and I mean, they used to say Bret, who at the time, and now we're talking like 92, even before they put the championship on him, and maybe this was one of the deciding factors. They said, you know, Bret would get more fan mail than anyone else in the entire company. You know, once Hogan was out of the picture, he had a certain, you know, support from the fans that very few people had. And I think that helped him. That saved him. Because were it not for that, I don't know that they would have gone as reliable as he was. Maybe they would have gone with somebody else. So he had that going for him. He had a vote of confidence from the people. But I never got the impression that he had that same vote of confidence from Vince McMahon. So I think you're right. I think, you know, for a lot of his career, he was the fallback guy. Howard from New York City. I have a question about the Ultimate Warrior and Jake Roberts. During a few segments in 1991, Jake was shown trying to get the Warrior to get rid of his fear of snakes in a room full of snakes. But after those segments, Warrior and Jake never feuded. If they had feuded, what would have been the outcome? I think he was trying to get him to... the whole point of the feud, I think the feud was he was trying to get him to conquer the dark side because Warrior was kind of feuding with Undertaker at the time. Had they feuded, I'm sure Warrior would have won because he didn't lose very often. But they fired him, so Jake transitioned into his feud instead with Randy Savage, and thank God he did. Talk about lucking into something. Talk about falling ass backwards into a fucking pot of gold. I think that was the best thing that could have happened. You kidding me? I'll take that Jake Roberts-Randy Savage feud over Jake and the Warrior any day of the week. Steven in San Jose. Is it just me or did WCW blatantly rip off actual songs for a lot of their talent? DDP's was obviously a Nirvana ripoff, but I've noticed others like Raven and Jeff Jarrett. How did they not get sued? I'm guessing they altered them just enough maybe to fly under the radar. ECW got away with illegally using the actual music, but they were so small, nobody important ever really noticed. I mean, if they tried that shit today, it'd be all over social media. The record companies would know in a fucking split second. But yeah, WCW did that a lot. I mean, Smells Like Teen Spirit for DDP was the most obvious one. Jeff Jarrett, I think, was Kid Rock, right? It was Cowboy, which actually used to be our intro here for the podcast many years ago. Raven was, I think Raven was also Nirvana. I think it was Come As You Are, is what, if you listen to that song, you can hear the similarities there. You forgot Chris Jericho's theme, his heel theme, which was very clearly a ripoff of Pearl Jam's Even Flow. I mean, it's just, it's comical how obvious it is. Off the top of my head, I don't know any others. I'm sure they did it with a bunch of other people too, but they were good though. I mean, so, like DDP's music and even Jericho's, I mean, they were good. I liked those songs. WCW songs generally were always more generic sounding than WWE. I always gave, I mean, Jim Johnston was the fucking man. But I did like a lot of the knockoff WCW themes. They weren't bad. Dominic has a buy or sell. Ricky the Dragon Steamboat's more famous intercontinental title win at WrestleMania 3, or his more prestigious NWA world title win over Ric Flair? I am going to buy on the NWA title win just because, you know, I know that WrestleMania 3 match is just so famous, and we every year we see the highlights of it and people talk about it. But the NWA title really meant something back then. I mean, the NWA title was viewed as the most prestigious championship in all of wrestling, you know, in the 80s. And Flair and Steamboat, maybe it doesn't get as much attention and isn't part of as many highlight packages as Savage and Steamboat, because that was on a WrestleMania show and the Flair-Steamboat matches were not, which is exactly why it doesn't get the same attention, and I think the only reason. Because that Savage Steamboat match was awesome, but so were Flair and Steamboat. They were every bit as awesome, if not more so. So if you're talking in terms of the matches themselves, I think they match up pretty well, and if I had to give the edge to one over the other, I'm giving the edge to Flair and Steamboat. I mean, you talk about a fucking classic series of matches, probably the most classic series of matches in the history of wrestling, at least in this country. I mean, I don't want to start getting into Misawa and Kawada and Kobashi. I mean, maybe, again, maybe there's a bigger feud, you know, in Japan or something, but certainly in this country, I think it's Flair Steamboat, and then everybody else is just lagging behind. And you just look at the championships. Championships meant more back then. The Intercontinental title was looked at as the workhorse belt. It was a lot more prestigious than it is today in terms of its place in the company and what it meant to be given that championship. But the Intercontinental title did not match up to the NWA title back in the day. The NWA title was, you know, the pinnacle. You can't compare the two. You're comparing a secondary championship in WWE to the fucking NWA World Heavyweight Championship. And you know, it's funny to look at what happened subsequent to Steamboat winning the championships, because in WWE, he didn't even have a run. I mean, it was such a waste. You know, he asked for time off, and that's just something he didn't do back then, so they fucking took the title off of him against Honky Tonk Man. He didn't even have a run. He lost the belt like 3 months later. With the NWA title, I mean, Steamboat, I don't even remember. I mean, did Steamboat even have it for that long? He didn't have the belt for that long. So I'm trying to think, like, aside from the Flair stuff, there isn't a whole lot, to me anyway, that's memorable about Steamboat's runs with the NWA title. So, again, something they have in common. It's not like Steamboat went on a tear with that belt for 6 months or a year and had these great matches with everybody. No, I mean, it's kind of like just, all right, Flair, and then Steamboat wins, and then it kind of trade wins back and forth. It's just that one feud, really. So, to me, it just boils down to, you know, match quality and then the significance of the belt. And you can't put the significance of the Intercontinental title over the NWA belt back then. You just can't do that. So I'm going to buy on the win over Flair, and I'm going to sell on the win over Savage. Bill Mitchell, who has been listening to this show since episode 50-something, so shout out to Bill. He has a unique buy or sell. I've heard you say, or at least imply, on a couple of occasions, that TNA has been lucky to be given chances. I also heard the Stone Cold podcast, and he said that he was lucky to have certain things happen that ensured that the Stone Cold character would take off. This was during the Stone Cold podcast he did with Shawn Michaels on the network. Among them, the MSG click curtain call, Triple H being in the doghouse, Jake Roberts being born again, and Michael Hayes letting Austin know what Jake said while Austin was away at the hospital the night he won King of the Ring. With all of that said, buy or sell on who did more with the luck they were handed, Stone Cold Steve Austin or TNA? I don't even know how this is a question, Bill. I mean, come on. Obviously, I'm buying on Stone Cold and I'm selling on TNA. I mean, I am a believer that Austin was going to be a big star no matter what. So, on the podcast he did with Sean, Austin flat out said that were it not for all of those things happening, there would be no Stone Cold Steve Austin. I don't believe that. I have a little more faith in him than maybe he does. I think he would have ended up being a big star. But yeah, Austin 316, in terms of how popular that made him and all the fucking t-shirts this guy sold, I think that it may still be the highest selling t-shirt ever made. I mean, it was unbelievable. And it all stemmed from that King of the Ring speech. And yeah, I mean, when you look at all of those things, if Triple H didn't go into the doghouse for what happened at MSG, then he would have won King of the Ring that year. They've now admitted that on WWE's own DVD releases that Triple H was supposed to win in 96, and then instead they gave it to Austin. And then who he was matched up with and Jake being born again. It was this perfect storm of circumstances. But Austin made the most of it. And he went on to become maybe the most popular. I mean, Hogan was still more widely known. But I don't know. I mean, for that period of 2 or 3 years there, I don't know that there's anybody who's ever had a better run in the business than Steve Austin did. I look at TNA. TNA has somehow survived. I give them credit for that. They've employed a lot of people. There'd be a lot of people, I can't even say out of work. I mean, they'd be working somewhere else were it not for TNA. I mean, they have a lot of talented guys there. It's not like, oh my God, if TNA went under, Rockstar Spud's going to be on the fucking breadline. Like, no, Rockstar Spud would probably end up making as much money, if not more, working for different indie promotions. But TNA has, you know, soldiered on. And they have employed a lot of people over the years. And I have made that comment before. I've made the comment that there has never been, ever, a wrestling organization that has been so fortunate to have as many opportunities as TNA has had. And that there has never been another wrestling promotion that has squandered as many opportunities as TNA has had. TNA got on a major cable station in whatever year it was, 2005, 2006, okay, Spike TV. Because when they were on Fox Sports Net, they didn't have a very big audience. They were paying for that airtime. It was like paid programming. But they got an actual TV deal with a major cable network, which was big. And, you know, they had a real opportunity to be something different from WWE. The X Division in its early years was something really special that should have been built on instead of torn down, which is what they did. People like Kurt Angle came in. Kurt Angle was one of the very few people, I think, that they brought in as far as big names from WWE that actually did initially make an impact. And him and Samoa Joe had that great feud, and they did a big buy rate on pay-per-view, and then they just never did it again. Like, I could go through a whole fucking list of things that TNA did. All the potential they had, the tools were there, the pieces were there, and they just couldn't put it together. And somehow, even though they would fuck it up every single time, just fuck up after fuck up, you know, they're bringing in Hogan and Bischoff, that turned out to not be such a smart move. All the different things they did, and all the nonsense. There was a period of time there on Impact where, oh my God, I mean, I couldn't watch the show. I mean, I finally got into the show once, you know, the Russo era came to an end, and it actually seemed like a coherent television show. And I was consistently watching Impact for a good 2 years or so until I just, you know, it went off the rails again and I just gave up. But just opportunity after opportunity. You know how many wrestling companies and indie promotions out there would kill to have television on Spike TV? I mean, Ring of Honor, I know they're owned by Sinclair, and this Comet TV thing they're on now is a Sinclair thing. Do you not think that Ring of Honor would have killed to be on a Spike TV? Of course they would have. Of course they would have. And who knows what would have happened? Maybe they would have flopped. Maybe they wouldn't have. Maybe they would have done things right the way that TNA should have done things right, but didn't. We'll never know. But a Ring of Honor, Lucha Underground. Lucha Underground is fucking awesome. But they're still on the El Rey Network. And the El Rey Network does not have much of an audience. I would love to see a Lucha Underground get on a Spike TV or an FX or some station like that. Because I really believe that if more people had exposure to it, it would take off. But they don't. It's very hard to get a TV deal. Look at Jeff Jarrett. All this talk about the boom that's coming and Global Force Wrestling, and they taped all that television. I don't even know if that television is ever going to air. They may end up having to release it on fucking DVD at some point, because that may be the only way we ever see it. If it was so simple, if it was so easy to get a TV deal, Jeff Jarrett would have had one 6 months ago. There's a reason why we haven't heard anything about Global Force Wrestling getting on TV. It's not easy. Nobody wants wrestling. Nobody major, anyway. I mean, yeah, you can get on a Destination America, and then even Destination America boots you off. I mean, they'd rather turn into 24 hours of fucking seances and exorcisms than keep pro wrestling on their network. I mean, what does that say about the interest level out there in pro wrestling? It's a good thing that WWE is locked into that deal they have with USA, the way the Raw ratings have been going. They don't really have anything to worry about. But if they had a contract that was coming due, and their ratings were going down, down, down the way they have been before this week, they may be in a lot of trouble. Because I don't know how many potential suitors there would be out there, even for WWE. They found that out the hard way many years ago when they had to go crawling back to USA and taking a lesser deal because they shopped around and nobody wanted them. So here's TNA. Despite all of their failures and fuck-ups over the years and stupid decisions, they are still on television. Now they're on Pop TV. You know, they could have very easily faded away. So I give them credit. They negotiated a new TV deal where they're going to be paid for their programming. And Pop TV, they're getting some new clearances, like I said earlier. You know, if you've got Cablevision now, it's clearing Cablevision in mid-January, so we'll get the channel now. They have been very, very lucky. Luck has as much to do with their success as anything, because all it takes is a Spike TV many years ago to say, we don't want this anymore, and just pull the plug. And that would have been it. TNA would have been done. All it takes is Dixie Carter's father to go, I'm tired of losing money on this. I'm pulling the plug. And without that money from mommy and daddy, there is no TNA. So when I say that they've been very lucky, that's what I mean by it. They've somehow managed to stay on TV, whatever, you know, different channels, for a decade now, over a decade, despite the fact that TNA has been a punchline for much of that run. Not all of it, but, you know, a lot of those years they've been a punchline, and they have made some very stupid mistakes. If any other wrestling company made stupid mistakes the way TNA did, they would have been dead years ago. So even though TNA has managed to stay alive for 13 years or whatever it's been, how can I sit here and say that TNA did more with the luck they were given? No, they haven't. They really haven't. You would think that after a while they would be like, hey, you know, we ought to make the most of things here and actually, you know, start making some sane decisions here. And it's just, I don't know, with TNA it just feels like the same song and dance. Nothing ever changes. It's a dead product. There's no buzz. There's no life to it. Maybe now there will be. Maybe they'll debut on Pop TV and they'll have a bunch of new people make their debut and it'll be like a new lease on life. For their sake, I hope it is. But TNA, to me, they're not living so much as they're just existing. They exist. Steve Austin took what was given to him. He was very lucky things, you know, happened the way they did. And he became the biggest star in the business. I mean, how can you say that TNA is more successful than Stone Cold Steve Austin? So this is an easy buy on Austin and a sell on TNA, which is what TNA should be doing anyway. Maybe they would be able to turn things around if they sold. It is the start of our WCW countdown. 15 weeks we will be doing this countdown. culminating on the anniversary of the death, the 15-year anniversary of the death of WCW. As I said earlier, this list is spanning only WCW-era matches after Jim Crockett Promotions sold to Ted Turner, which was at the end of 88. So basically from 89 onward. I started with a list of 24. When I initially came up with this idea and I wanted to do this, I had 24 matches jotted down as the my favorite WCW matches, and in my opinion, the top WCW matches in history. I had 24 of them. And I said, we're going to do one match a week for 15 weeks. We've got to cut this list down. And I was able to cut it down to 21. So to get this list down to 15 has not been easy. There's a lot of matches that are very, very good that I would love to have on this list, but we had to get it down to 15. So I've narrowed it down. We're going to do one match per week. This is in no particular order. So I don't want people thinking, well, you know, the first match I'm doing here is number 15, and then the last match we do is the best match at number one. That's not how this is going to work. Match number one here on the list is a War Games match. I mentioned that earlier. And it is a War Games match from Wrestle War in 1991, February 24th, 1991, the night that Sid almost legitimately killed Brian Pillman. It was Sting, Pillman, and the Steiner Brothers against Ric Flair, Barry Windham, Larry Zbysko, and Sid Vicious. And I am still holding out hope that one day WWE may wake up and make War Games the new annual Survivor Series tradition. I don't know how many years I've been crowing about this for. If I held my breath waiting on that, though, I would be dead. It was the brainchild, War Games was, of the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes, who went to go see Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome after the movie came out and said, hey, I've got a great idea for a wrestling match. And so War Games was born. The very first one was held in 1987. It's a great match. I just rewatched it a few weeks ago. It would have easily made this list if we were including matches pre-88, which we're not. It consisted of two rings side by side with a cage over them. So if you are a newer fan, if you're a younger fan, if you've never had any exposure to War Games before, it's quite the sight. You've never seen anything quite like this in WWE, and it's mainly the two rings, right? WWE's never done anything like that before. Each team sends a man in for the first 5 minutes, and then there is a coin toss, and the team that wins the coin toss sends a man in for the two-on-one advantage. And each period thereafter is now 2 minutes long, and the other team gets to send a man in next, and they rotate back and forth. The match cannot end until all eight men are in, at which point it becomes submission or surrender only. There's no pinfalls, there's no disqualifications. Those are the rules. We have Jim Ross and Dusty Rhodes on commentary for the match, and this was right after Dusty got fired from WWE, because he and Dustin had lost to DiBiase and Virgil at the Royal Rumble in January. It was the month before this, so he didn't waste any time in getting back into WCW. And not surprisingly, these guys were great together. You had the guy who conceived of the War Games match, who more than anybody knew how to get this match over, and was in the very first War Games matches. You have him on commentary. And you've got Jim Ross. I mean, what more can be said about Jim Ross? I mean, the announcing here was just a breath of fresh air. You know, I don't know if Mauro Ranallo can bring this kind of announcing to SmackDown. If he does, I'm sure they'll, you know, beat it out of him after a while. But he may be the closest thing to a Jim Ross type of announcer that there is in wrestling right now. So if Vince McMahon ever, I don't know, slips in the shower and hits his head on the sink and forgets who he is, maybe Triple H can take over and produce the announcers from now on in a different way. And he can kind of loosen the reins a little bit and let a guy like Mauro do what he does best. Arn Anderson was out there with the Horsemen. He was not in the match. He had just been injured, I think, not long before this. So Larry Zbysko took his place. That's why Zbysko just feels out of place here. It was really the Horsemen against Sting's team. Zbysko was not a member of the Horsemen, so that's why he was in this match. They shot an angle on WCW Saturday night, I think it might have been the night before this, where the Horsemen attacked Brian Pillman, went after his shoulder, and that was really the story of the match. It played into the very beginning, and it played into the very end. Pillman's shoulder, all taped up, really has no business starting the match, And the baby faces are out there, I guess, trying to figure out who's going to start. And Pillman just says, yeah, he's just so full of piss and vinegar. Before Sting could even grab him and stop him, he just says, fuck it, I'm going in. And he charges into the cage, and he makes himself the first man for his team. In fact, not only does Pillman start the match for his team, he busts open Barry Windham within the first 2 minutes. 2 minutes in, and this guy had 20 more to go, and he's just bleeding all over the place. There was so much blood that when Windham would get his face raked across the cage, you could see blood. You could actually see from the hard cameras, which is pretty far out. It's not like they zoomed in on this. You could see the blood stains on the chain link fence. This is what War Games should be. This is, in a perfect world, what Hell in a Cell should be still. And it's why I'm glad Undertaker and Brock Lesnar both got color at this year's show. The heels, of course, win the coin toss in this match. They get the man advantage, which is good wrestling psychology. Had they done a War Games match years ago in TNA, they would have rigged it somehow where the babyfaces got a fucking 4-on-1 advantage. And actually, you know, that's something WWE would probably do now too, so I have to mock them for that as well. Ric Flair is in next, reigning NWA champion at the time. Sting comes in next for his team. He runs wild. You know, watching Sting and Flair back in the day, it never gets old. Zbyszko is in next. Sting goes after him. Sting flies from one ring to the other. He flies literally from the first ring over the ropes into the second ring. The building at this point is just going insane. This crowd here in Phoenix, man, I miss crowds like this. You know, that's why when I'm talking about NXT TakeOver earlier, that's a different kind of crowd, okay? You didn't have a crowd like that that did all the weird chants and everything back in the day. And I do miss crowds that just, when they got excited, they would just cheer. I do miss that. But it's also why I can't hate on the NXT crowd. I don't understand why people were so pissed off with these British fans. Like, you know, why don't you take the stick and remove it from your ass? I wish all crowds were as energetic as those crowds were in London. You know, I love having a crowd like that. But I'm watching this, and you know, those NWA crowds, those people, they believed. You know, it was just a different time, more so than WWF at the time. These crowds, they were invested in these guys. They believed that all of these guys were just tough guys, and they wanted to see the bad guys get their asses kicked. They wanted the horsemen to get their asses kicked. It was just a different vibe back then. So now Flair is bleeding, of course. I mean, if just as soon as the wind blows and the sun comes up during the daytime, you know Ric Flair is going to bleed. So he's bleeding. Windham is still bleeding. They're working over Pillman's shoulder. Sting's on a rampage. This War Games match is just pure chaos at this point. Rick Steiner is in next, followed by Big Sid. They save Scott Steiner for last, and now it's submission or surrender. One thing that did stand out to me going back and watching this match was Sid's loud spot calling. He wasn't quite as bad as John Cena, but I counted at least three different times where he was talking to the other guy. At one point in all of this mayhem, all of the baby faces lock all of the heels in stereo figure four leg locks, which was very cool. Nobody gave up. Match continues. And then came one of the scariest things that I have ever seen. So back in these old War Games matches, the roof of the cage was very low. It was much lower than, for example, the one for Hell in a Cell that WWE uses today. Even the roof for Hell in a Cell when it first debuted was a lot lower, I think, than it is now. Sid forgot to take that into consideration when he set Brian Pillman up for the powerbomb. He picks him up, but he cannot get Pillman up for the full rotation because Pillman's feet hit the ceiling. And so instead of putting him back down and readjusting, which would have been the smart thing to do, Sid violently slams Pillman straight down on the back of his neck. Dusty Rhodes lets out an "Oh Jesus" on commentary, which was probably a shoot, because that's what I said the first time I saw this. Pillman is just out of it at this point. He's lucky he wasn't paralyzed for life. When I said at the beginning that this was the night that Sid almost legitimately killed Brian Pillman, I'm not joking. Brian Pillman could have died on that spot. He's very, very lucky, at the very least, he wasn't paralyzed. So what does Sid do? He picks Pillman up and says, well, let's try it again. He gives him a second powerbomb. as if the first one wasn't enough. This time, at least, he landed it safely. Elegante, in his pre-Giant Gonzalez days, all 8 feet of him, he runs down to the ring. He pleads with the referees to stop the match, which they do. Sting's team forfeits the match due to Pillman's injury, and the Horsemen get the win. Jim Ross kept referring to Pillman as Elegante's little buddy on commentary, like they were friends. I don't know if that was something they established prior to this on TV or not. I would have to think that maybe they did. Maybe they did some tag team matches together or something. I don't know. I wasn't watching the television leading up to this show. After the match, JR interviews Nick Patrick, who is the lead official. Nick Patrick explains why they stopped the match, which doesn't need much of an explanation at all. This was bell-to-bell action. I mean, despite the finish and as gruesome as that looked, it may well have been the planned finish anyway. It told a great story. It was brutal. It was exciting. This, to me, is what pro wrestling is all about. Now, there were two big defections not long after this match. Sid left a few months later for WWE, and Ric Flair, around that same time, he had his falling out with Jim Herd. Jim Herd was WCW's president at the time. Before that, Herd was a manager for Pizza Hut. True story. He wanted to cut Ric Flair's pay. He wanted to shave Ric Flair's head, or at least cut his hair, and change Flair's name to Spartacus. So I guess, you know, instead of pepperoni, he must have been sprinkling angel dust on those pizzas to come up with shit like that. Flair wisely told him to fuck off. Maybe not in those exact words. Or maybe he did. Maybe he did use those exact words. Because 2 weeks before Flair's title defense against Lex Luger at the Great American Bash, Herd fired him. He fired his world champion. Flair wanted the $25,000 deposit back that he had put down on the belt. WCW wouldn't give him his money back. And that opened the door for him to take the big gold belt and go work for WWF. Vince McMahon was more than happy to have him in there. Bobby Heenan popped up on TV with the belt a few months later. So as a result of all of this, the Great American Bash Show in 91 is an infamous one because of how badly the crowd turned on it. They were not happy with the Lex Luger-Barry Windham match that they ended up doing in place of what should have been Flair and Luger. And Luger won the belt. I mean, these people chanted, "We want Flair," all night long. One of our listeners, Eric, you know, he wrote in to me. He's an older fan. He wrote in to tell me how much he was looking forward to the countdown. He was a huge NWA fan back in the day, and he was actually in Baltimore at the show live at the Great American Bash. And he says, when you watch it on the network, it doesn't even do justice to how pissed off that crowd was. He said, what WCW essentially did that night, they killed the town. They killed Baltimore for a good 6 years after that, which just makes me now want to go back and watch the Great American Bash on the network, which I may do after I'm done here. One more follow-up on the Sid and Pillman stuff here later on in the year. I mentioned Sid left for WWF. Later in the year, WWF and WCW, they must have been running shows pretty close together because a bunch of the wrestlers were at a bar. So you had WWF guys, you had WCW guys, variations of this story, but I think the consensus is kind of on this version of events. Sid may have been drunk. He started spouting off of the mouth about what a big star he was and putting down the smaller wrestlers. Pillman had heard enough. He stood up to Sid. There may or may not have been a scuffle. What is for sure is that Sid left the bar. He came back with a squeegee in his hand to fight Brian Pillman. This was the infamous squeegee story and why Sid got the nickname Squeegee Sid. So he went from Squeegee Sid to Scissors Sid to Psycho Sid and Softball Sid because he loved to play softball. He was very well known for his love of softball. So anyway, that's the year 1991 for WCW and the Great War Games match at WrestleWar. Next week, we will do match number 2 on this, the 15 greatest matches in WCW history countdown. And don't forget, I'm also going to go through my top 10 matches for 2015, which will cover WWE, TNA, ROH, New Japan, Lucha Underground, at least the matches I saw. We will rank them. Are we going to rank them? No, we're not going to rank them. We're going to list them. I am very cautious here. I hate ranking things. Like, this is number two and this is number one. Like, what's the fucking difference? You know what I mean? So we're not ranking them so much as we're listing them. The top 10 matches of 2015, that'll be next week. Follow me on Twitter at Solomonster. Don't forget to vote in our Raw poll every Monday night as soon as Raw goes off the air. You can vote thumbs up, thumbs down. I also want to just quickly promote Zach Holker, one of the members of our Facebook group. He does an annual Royal Rumble pool. This will be the third or fourth year in a row that he's doing it. The pool is now underway. You can find the thread in the Facebook group. It is sticky to the top, although once this podcast goes up, I'm going to unsticky it, but you can find it in there. If you want to be part of the pool, all you have to do is find the post and like it, or you can type in, I'm in. And the way it works is, you know, you'll randomly be assigned a number, and, I mean, it's not complicated how these things work. You're randomly assigned a number, and you want your guy to win. That's how this works. And each year we've done this, and I think this is the third year now. The numbers go up, like way, way up in terms of people who participate. So if you want to get in on that, go to the Facebook group. And if you're not in there, you have to apply for membership. I can approve you. And you can be part of our Royal Rumble pool. And I want to thank Zach for running it. He puts a lot of effort into it. Also, don't forget, leave us some feedback in iTunes and on Stitcher. We are a 5-star rated podcast on iTunes. And when you write a review on there, you can give us a star rating, but you could also actually write out a review. It helps us out a lot, and it lets other people know, hey, this is something I should be listening to. So you can do that on iTunes, you can do that on Stitcher. And I want to just also mention one quick thing about Podbean here. Some of you were complaining, and I'm sure will probably complain again when this show goes up, that you are used to downloading the MP3 on your phone directly from Podbean if you don't want to stream it. Maybe you don't have Wi-Fi, you have, you know, data caps or whatever. And you were asking me, how come now, all of a sudden, when you go to download the show on your phone, on your device, from Podbean, it no longer gives you a download link. Instead, it directs you to download the Podbean app. I checked with Podbean on that, and it is a change that they made. They are trying to steer people to download the app. For whatever it's worth, I have the Podbean app on my phone, and it works great. You know, the shows come up. It is free. You can get it on iPhone, Android. So I would just advise you to give it a shot, but if you want to download the actual MP3, you can still do so. The thing is, though, you're going to have to do it on your computer. You're not going to be able to do it on your device anymore. If you go on the computer, you go to that same download page, you will get the link. You can download the show that way and then transfer it onto your phone. I know it's a little bit of a pain in the ass, but that's just how it is. It's a change that Podbean made. I had nothing to do with it. But just to let you know, if you do want the MP3, it is not impossible. You can still get it, but you got to do it on the computer. So, with that being said, I want to wrap things up here. Thank you, as always, for supporting this podcast. We are heading into Christmas this week. I know a lot of you are celebrating the holidays and, getting ready. You got the tree up and all that kind of stuff. So, if you are celebrating, I want to wish you a very Merry Christmas. I want to wish everybody happy holidays, whatever you may be celebrating. And we will be back, as normal, with the podcast next weekend. That'll be episode 415. I'm also planning on getting up that TV Tracks Q&A. It will be exclusive to his YouTube channel. And my plan is to record on Christmas Eve and get it up shortly thereafter. So you can still get in your questions if you want to be part of that. So until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a very Merry Christmas, and I will see you right back here for more Sound Off next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
Hulk Hogan's WCW contract splattered all over the internet. He got a $2 million signing bonus, 25% of the ticket revenue from all Nitro and Thunder events that he appeared on. He also got $20,000 per month for as long as he was part of the NWO, 50% of the profits from any Hulk Hogan merchandise that was sold, and a minimum $675,000 for any pay-per-view he appeared on. You know what I say? I say good for him. If I could get that kind of deal for myself, if somebody wanted me that badly, they were that stupid, then great! Always ask for what you feel you're worth. Your boss should have the guts to say no. WCW wanted to blow this guy so badly, they put a towel down on the floor so they wouldn't get rug burned.
Solar Monster sounds off.
Since 2007, the Solar Monster sounds off. Available at thesolarmonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solar Monster sound off.